Welcome to Flip the Script, a mental health podcast. I'm your host, Jana Cohn. Whether you know the darkness of depression yourself or have supported someone in their pain, you've come to the right place. My mission is to empower you to take control of your mental health because nothing else in this entire world matters more. If you're listening in the midst of depression right now, I hope this show gives you assurance that you are not alone and that life doesn't have to be so hard. But you must first desire to feel better and get better. This podcast is a step in the right direction. If you're listening because you're walking alongside someone dealing with depression, thank you. You can always find me on Instagram at jana.cohn and be sure you're subscribed to my email list in the show notes so you never miss an episode. Together, we can flip the script on mental health. Enjoy. I am really looking forward to this conversation. I know that it is a topic, as you have said in your book yourself, that sometimes people can be really uncomfortable with. So, Alexandra, thank you for just taking the time, one, to be on the podcast today and to share your book with me. And I know that this conversation, coupled with your book, which I could not put down, by the way, it is one of those books that truly sucked me in right away from your intro. When I read it, I was just like, oh gosh, this is so good and so needed and so raw. So thank you for being here with us today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me, Jana. I'm so excited to be here. And yeah, the more that we can normalize these tough conversations, I feel the more healing that can be had. So thank you.
Yes. And your book came out recently. I know I was able to read kind of a pre-released copy, which I did. And then I also ordered the real deal so I could have it on my bookshelf. So how long has your book been out now?
Oh, good. Oh, that's a good question. I think just over 4 months. It came out in November of 2022.
Yeah. What prompted you to write this book? I mean, obviously the event, you know, leading up to it and what you went through your husband's death, but what sparked your interest in, I'm going to do a book? Because there are so many different outlets that we can put content out now, you know, free apps, video content, YouTube, all the things. But there is something that I love about a physical book. So what was it that made you decide, I want to do a book with this?
Yeah. Well, first I'll say all of those outlets are phenomenal. And I am one of the least technologically savvy people. So while there's a lot of easier ways to get content out, I've always been a writer. It's just been my outlet. And one of the things I do like about a book is you can go back and reference it. I have books on my shelf that I've read several times and get something different out of them each time. But really my process started out of just feeling that there was a need for something like this. So after my husband passed, I was gifted some really nice books and journals and things on prayer, but nothing really said, you can get through this. This is awful. You can get through this. Some people might, you know, end up having intense grief reactions and put their grief on you. And here's how we can handle that. I mean, literally it was kind of a shit hit the fan, now what kind of situation. And I didn't really feel that I had much guidance. I will say I've known other individuals who've lost a loved one to suicide who've had some great resources. I just initially didn't. I had family and friends who could help, but no one had been through anything like this. So right. really what I wanted to do was help either help someone through their own process so that they would know that they're not alone and that you can get to the other side of this, or to help people understand that the situation they have is encouraging and to really embrace the support that they're getting. Because I feel like in my experience, either some people have it kind of like my own, where there might be threats of legal action, there's going to be a lot of blame being slung, anger, judgment, or some people rally. And either way, just to say you can get through this and to kind of give a guide to that, because it was just something that I needed and I just started writing it down and it worked out that I could actually publish it, which has been amazing.
Right. I think that's a really good description word to use as a guide, because as I was reading through it, one, you know, you say in the book, you know, when I was going through it, there was nothing that I found that was like this. So it's a guide not only for the emotional side of processing and this different stages of grief that you go through, but also it is such a useful guide for tactical things that one needs to consider when, you know, such as a will, you know, have something mm-hmm. written down. But also in the back of the book, what I loved and thought was so genius is you go through the different terms or the different things that you need to know about: mutual bank accounts, life insurance, autopsy. All of these things, like you said, are a guide to help someone if they have gone through a similar event or just want to be smart, such as having, you know, having a will written down, because we can have conversations all we want with our loved ones, our spouse. But like you said, at the end of the day, when it comes to legalities, you have to have something written down. And so I feel like the value that you bring to the table in this book is not only emotional support, but really tangible things that people need to consider. And should they find themselves in a similar situation, things that they need to know about. So I think that it's just such a well-rounded book. I can't say that enough to you. So I think it's just so incredible.
Well, thank you. And I do say, you know, get the business done when you feel good. And I think sometimes people think that if they write a will when they're feeling good, they're going to bring on death. Or if they contemplate what they would like for their end of life, then they're bringing it on. And the answer to that is no, but it's like there's so much, you don't know how you're going to grieve. There were so many things about my own grieving process I didn't know until I was in the middle of it. So I like to encourage people, have your will done, have whatever you need, all of that business taken care of when you feel good, so that when you're in a moment of despair that you don't have to worry about it. And I say the same thing for emotional tools as well. You know, get yourself in some good habits, momentums, find those tools that work for you when you feel great. If it's exercise or journaling or meditating or therapy, whatever it is, do it when you feel good. Don't just tap into your resources when you don't feel well, because once you get that momentum, they're easier to access. Not that it's easy, but easier to access.
Right.
But thank you for, and I'd say for the business side, I don't think anyone really realizes, at least for me, I didn't realize how much you have to do in regards to things like what kind of death certificates do you have to have, you know, autopsy, what's going to happen. You don't know about any of that until you're in the moment. And then it's very quick that you have to make these decisions. I had to make decisions within the first 2 weeks. I couldn't even wrap my head around my situation before I was being asked all sorts of questions and what to do for memorial or what. And I was very overwhelmed. So I appreciate your positive feedback on this, because I hope that it can be a resource, not just for individuals who've lost a loved one to suicide, but for anybody, because anybody can be going through grief. Anyone can go through loss. And hopefully this would be helpful for that.
Absolutely. One thing that really stood out to me, and it's, you know, kind of the framework for the whole book, we hear about the stages of grief, right? That are the clinical stages of grief. But when put into practice, it is not always so linear. And so you came up with your own framework. And what I loved about it that you said was, one, it's not linear. You're not always going to experience this and then this and then this. Sometimes you can experience multiple stages at the same time. So when you were going through those actual stages of grief that you retitled, and we can go through all of those, were you able to put words to the different stages you were going through at the time, or did it come to you in hindsight when you went back to write this book?
Yeah. Oh, that's a really good question. I would say they came to me when I was more actively writing. So a lot of the reflection happened after I actually went through whatever it was I was going through. So for instance, you know, the shock and awe is the first phase that I talk about. And I'll say this, the emotions of the stages of grief, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Did I get that right? Yes. You know, those are constant. So they're going to be happening all the time at different rates. And so for me, it was more of the more transitions of being able to handle life versus the emotional aspect of it. So for me, in the shock and awe, I literally felt the shock lift, and I didn't realize that I had been in shock. Obviously I knew in the immediacy that I was in shock, but my shock officially lifted 4 months after Sean passed, and I felt it. And then it felt like a ton of bricks, because all of the emotion, all of the reality, I was in my living room. I stared at the front door and went, oh my goodness, he's not coming through that door. This is okay. This is for real. Now I got to figure this out. The shock is your body and your brain trying to protect you from something so horrific. So it's not like you can have control over when that shock is going to lift. Like it's going to at a natural point when your body and brain are able to say, okay, now you can start to handle this. But all in that first 4 months was I dealing with all of these other emotions that were going on, and they all come. I mean, it can feel like a tsunami where you're just trying to breathe and can't, because it's intense. It's very intense. The now what phase is the second phase that I call and termed, because it's, you're bridging two different experiences. You have people by that point in time, right? But at that point, it was 4.5 months. People are going back, already back at work. They're going back to their families, their life. They're like, cool, all right, you know, you're doing your thing. You're a single mom now. I'm going to go over here and hang out with my family. So you have this side where you have to almost reintegrate with society, get back to work. You have to figure out your groceries, those normal things that we do day to day. And then at the same time, though, in my opinion, you can't fully really start to embrace your grieving journey while you're in the shock, because you're not facing everything clearly yet. And so in the now what phase, now you're not only dealing with, I have to function daily like people do. I've got a house I got to take care of, a child I have to take care of. There's that life stuff. But then I've got this massive emotional journey, this grief journey in front of me. And now how do I embrace that? Because the two don't always jive. And so... although my work was great and they met me where I was, I mean, there were times I just go into the bathroom and cry for 10 minutes before, you know, wipe my eyes. And of course, everyone can tell you've been crying, but then, you know, get back up and go back out to work. And so it's a balance. It's hard to figure out how to balance those two. And then the third one is The Collateral Beauty. And honestly, I was inspired by the actual movie Collateral Beauty in the idea of, you know, you can get tunnel vision with your grieving journey and you get tunnel vision with your day-to-day life and what has happened and thinking of life as happening to you, not for you. And I appreciated the concept of taking a step back and starting to see just what is left in this life for me and my son, and being able to embrace that and go, okay, I do have a grieving journey for the rest of my life, because there are going to be times forever now that I'm going to remember my late husband, and it's going to strike me in different ways. And that's okay, because it's going to morph and change. But at the same time, at the same time, I can also still find joy in what's in front of me. I can still put one foot in front of the other. I can still plan, and I can still build a life that's still here on earth, and embrace it and still have joy, essentially, is really what it comes down to. Because it's very easy to get stuck in grief, very easy to get stuck in those feelings of denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Acceptance, I'd say, and I think often acceptance is, I'm going to go on a quick tangent here. Often I feel like acceptance is, oh, my person has died. But I feel like there's, grief is so much bigger than that, and acceptance is so much bigger than that, because grief is more than just the loss of the person. You have the loss of who you were with that person, where your life was going. And then there's even grief over what your life is now, like after your person has died. So it's not so linear, and just like those feelings and the stages aren't linear. It's a complex process.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because when you look at those clinical descriptions of the grieving process, it seems like it's so definitive that if you don't go from this stage to this stage to this stage, or if you're hung up in one longer, then like you're not grieving correctly.
Yeah.
Or you're like, okay, if I can just get to this next stage of grief, then I will be almost finished with the grief process. And that never stops. And that's what I feel like is so relatable with these different phases of grief, the shock and awe, now what, and collateral beauty, is that they're not always happening, but there's no definitive beginning and end. You might deal with shock and awe still years later when something comes up, but still be able to live in that collateral beauty stage. I just think that for me, in reading it, it totally changed the way that I look at grief, and not even that it only applies to grieving in losing someone to suicide, but in any form of, you know, death and grieving, you can still identify with these stages. And I just think that it's brilliant that you came up with that. What is your background in? Because you are some sort of counselor, right? Or you've done counseling or something like that?
No, I'm okay. No, no. I know I'm actually, I do coaching around this now, but my background is as a pediatric occupational therapist. So I work with babies 0 to 3 years old to help them with their developmental milestones. So I call them pings, a lot of the ideas I feel weren't just me, but were others working through me in order to try and put all these concepts together. I've always been one who's a helper and a giver and a cheerleader. I like to say I'm a cheerleader, even though I've never actually been a cheerleader.
Yeah.
To help people work through whatever they need to step into their purpose and to do the things that they love. I did want to say, as far as the linear idea of the stages of grief, I think, and I haven't really studied those, I'll say, I have had a couple people say to me that they weren't meant to be linear. They were meant to just be, again, a guide. But I think as humans, we want something that's linear. We want the algorithm. We want the equation. If I do this, then I will feel this way. And the problem is that there's no guarantee in that. And there's no algorithm to life. There's no equation for grief. There are experiences and emotions you have to work through. And these are some of them. But there's no, and I'm an Aries. This is why I'm an Aries. So I was like, I'm going to take this on. I'm going to get to the other side of this grief process. Everything's going to go back to normal. And very quickly I learned, no, that's not how this works. You do have to work through what you're feeling. But there's no, the end goal, in my opinion, is just to continue healing. And so there's no ending, stopping point of it. There's no, I've arrived and gotten through my grief. And I appreciate that you're bringing light to that, because the more that people can, then I think it allows people to sit in the discomfort and work through it. Because once you get to the other side, it's way more freeing. It's absolutely more freeing once you can work through it and get to that other side. I just wanted to add that.
Right. Yeah. I think that's really brilliant. I thought for sure in reading the book, because it's so insightful, that you absolutely had some formal training in counseling or something in that field, which just goes.
I just read a lot of books.
Well, it just goes to show that through this tragedy that you went through, you were able to produce something that will help so many people. I'm sure that it already has. And one thing that I really loved in the book, when you talk about myths and misunderstandings, because one thing I've absolutely heard many times when someone speaks of suicide is suicide is the most selfish thing someone could ever do. Or it is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I bet majority of people listening have heard that when someone speaks of suicide, and they may have that personal belief now. But you really opened my eyes to that's actually not the case at all. And you talk a good bit in your book about your husband not being clinically depressed, which really resonated with me, because I, you know, my whole platform and podcast now has been built on my personal journey with depression. And many times I have shared with others and have had this thought myself, and people have asked me, well, were you suicidal, or are you suicidal? But I took a real interest in this book and this topic because even though I am clinically depressed, I've never identified with being suicidal. I've never had suicidal ideations or considered it or thought about it. And I've always been really perplexed by that, because I have often believed that the pinnacle of depression is suicide. And even when I look back on making the decision to do ketamine treatments, a lot of times ketamine is used for people that are actively suicidal because it can take you out of your current reality, totally dissociate. You almost feel like you die and come back to life. So I see why it's helpful for someone that's suicidal, but I have never been suicidal. And so before I got the ketamine infusions, I thought, you know, maybe I'm not depressed enough. Or since I'm not suicidal, it's not as bad as some others feel. But what you brought to the forefront in my mind is when you were talking about your husband, you said he wasn't clinically depressed and he did not believe that any medications or therapies would actually work for him. And he felt completely worthless or something to that degree. Therefore, that led to the suicide. And I thought that that was so interesting because as someone who is clinically depressed, there's a part of me that I don't believe that I am worthless, and I want nothing more than for medications or treatments or therapies or whatever to work for me, because I want to get on the other side of it, because I've had I know what it's like to be on the other side of it, and I know what it's like to be completely debilitated by depression. And so was just wondering if you could just speak to that a little bit more about what that looked like or felt like, and if that was something you realized after when you were searching for those answers that I think are very natural for anyone to come to. Whether, you know, they've lost someone to suicide or they hear of someone that has taken their life to suicide, is like, why? Or what was it? Or like, I'm so shocked. You know, that difference in that complete hopelessness, that worthlessness versus being depressed. Like, was that something that you recognized before the suicide happened, or is that something you were able to put into context after through your processing?
I think it's a combination. And first, I want to commend you for sharing. I think to have a platform like this and to actually share your story and be willing to be so vulnerable and open, I think is amazing. Recently, someone said to me, you have to go through vulnerability to reach courage. And I feel like this conversation demonstrates that really clearly. So thank you for what you're doing, because I feel that through what you're doing, others are going to feel more empowered. And I love that and appreciate that. I knew that Sean wasn't clinically depressed before he passed. And I knew that there were some struggles, and we would have discussions about some of the trauma and the reactions he'd have. And I would tell him, I can't tell where your trauma ends and I start. You know, no one's perfect in a relationship at all. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, you know, I can't work on myself to try and be a better wife for you if I can't tell, because some of the things that you're applying to me, I don't feel are really actual. So what's going on with that type of thing with his trauma? I think putting words to it and having a little bit more clarity about what was really going on for him came after. And I'll say I was someone who bought into the same ideas. I, you know, had two people that, as we're talking, come to mind that I had known, but on a peripheral level, right? So I had lots of assumptions and judgments. And then I just became so curious, similarly to what you're saying, when you're trying to search for answers to questions and you can't have them. I just started watching what I could, reading what I could, consulting with people, talking to a variety of therapists. Like, I need to understand. And I think when people want to apply labels, again, it's a way to create that distance. I'm safe because I don't have clinical depression. I'm safe because I have a good relationship. They must not have had a good relationship for him to do this. You know, we apply all sorts of reasons to distance ourselves from that pain versus saying life is going to hand us some pain and we can trust ourselves. This is what I like to say, right? We like to think of life as linear. You know, for me, it was go to college, meet someone, get buy a house, have your 2.5 children, your three dogs, your white picket fence. That's not how my life went at all. But that's what I bought into, is that's what a successful life looks like. Now I say, life is complete. Like, life is the ocean. What's predictable, right? Because predictability creates a sense of safety. What's predictable is us, that we trust ourselves. And when we can be really resolute in who we are, our purpose, and be grounded in that and can quiet the messages and projections of other people, then we can trust ourselves. Okay, life's going to hand me some stuff and I can get through it. But that feeling of trying to delineate and say, well, only, right, as you're saying, only depressed people will die this way. I mean, you can have clinical depression and not have high traumatic experiences, right? You know, and just the flip side, Sean had high traumatic experiences and didn't have clinical depression. So I think if we can, you know, kind of stay away from wanting to have those labels and just really evaluate each situation for what it is, it does take away that predictability of knowing who's going to die this way. But then we can really see people for who they are. And I think that's what we end up missing, is that Sean is way more, like, there's so much more to him than just his death. But because of how he died, that's what people tend to latch on to. And I think that's unfair to him. And it's unfair to anyone who's experiencing these kinds of thoughts or feelings, because they're more than their thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so powerful. And it's so true. And in looking back when Sean's suicide took place and you were in the throes of the shock and all, and your own grieving process, right, you know, freshly after, even though it's only been 2 years, if we go back 2 years in the, you know, the weeks and the months that followed shortly thereafter, one thing you said in your book that is so common, I kind of chuckled, because it seems like when someone dies by suicide, it's either a big secret that's how they passed, so there's no awareness brought to the forefront, or you, in the shoes of a spouse, it is looked at as you have kept some big secret of, she had to have seen this coming, or what happened? You know, that question, that thing that no one really wants to talk about. In hindsight, you know, now that you've written this book, you've been through all of this, you've experienced it, what do you wish in that time of your life? What do you wish someone would have said to you? Or what do you wish you would have been told? And I want to ask that because anyone listening has either dealt with suicide or they may deal with it in the future. And so I want us collectively to be able to know the right, quote unquote, right thing to say or do. Because I think in your book, you touch on a lot of, you know, the wrong kind of things to say or do, or,
sure,
you know, the shitty things people say of, oh gosh, what happened? Or like, how, what, you know? But what in that moment when you are the one left here to navigate life without that person, and especially you having, you know, your son in the midst of all of this, what do you wish someone would have said or done? Or is there anything someone can say or do to help?
Yeah. So I love this question, and I'm grateful that you're bringing light to this. So I actually, there's three times that people said things to me, and I needed it in the moment, and it was incredibly helpful. So in the midst of some of the chaos right after, I did have someone who's an important person to me. First thing out of his mouth was, no matter what anyone is saying, it wasn't your fault. Mm. And I just started bawling. And I needed to hear that, because that's immediately, I mean, you don't need, as a spouse, I didn't need other people to blame me, because I already started assuming that responsibility. I didn't need people to question my marriage, because I already was doing that. But to have someone say it's not your fault was very big. I don't know. I mean, that's an example. So I'd be mindful, you know, if you have someone who goes through it, you know, to just walk up and be like, it's not your fault kind of thing. Yeah. The second thing is that I had a state trooper who had to actually inform me that Sean had passed. She had lost her husband to suicide 8 months prior. And she knelt down in front of me and just said, I know you're not necessarily going to be able to hear this right now, but I want you to know that you can get through this, and you will. Mm-hmm. And that struck me at the time. I thought she was full of it, didn't want to hear it, but it stuck with me. And it gave me this like slight little bit of hope that I could kind of anchor and latch on to say, okay, it's going to take some work, but I can get through this.
Right.
Right. For the majority, though, I would say for the majority of people, if you know someone who's going through this, or if you yourself are, the big thing for me was just to have people tell me, I'm thinking about you, sending love your way, and I'm here for you. Right. Because a lot of people want to help. It's a hopeless situation when you're watching someone go through, helpless situation to watch a survivor go through this, because we're natural fixers as people. We want to fix situations. We want people to feel better and be happy. And this is not a situation that you can fix. And so when people would ask, what can I do for you? I mean, the thing I needed, I couldn't get, right? I needed my husband to be back alive and next to me. And I couldn't, that wasn't possible. Mm-hmm. So it created frustration, because they couldn't understand why I couldn't tell them what I needed. So often I just told people, just bring me food. I had food for a very long time. But I found throughout the time that the individuals who would just reach out, and I would tell them, like, please keep reaching out to me. I can't reach back out to you immediately, but I will eventually. And to just have people check in regularly, just thinking, they didn't want anything back from me. That's the big key here. Yeah. Is that if you're reaching out to someone, don't try not to want anything back from them. They just wanted me to know that they were there and ready for when I was ready. Yeah. And that was, I'd say, the biggest thing that I would recommend people do, is just let your person know that you are there and ready. And it may be that a year goes by before they're ready. So check in with yourself if you can be ready for them. I know there's a lot of be readies in there, but to just be available to the individual when they're ready to come to you, and knowing that. And it takes a lot, right? This is a very isolating process. It doesn't have to be isolating. It just naturally does become isolating. And it takes a lot for us as survivors to take that first step and say, okay, now I'm ready. But mm-hmm. to be able to reach out to people who are safe without that judgment, and to be able to put aside your own questions about the situation and just be available to listen. Those individuals who could do that for me, though, like, I am forever grateful to those right. individuals.
Right. And like you said, when someone like the state trooper that said to you, you know, you will get through this, even though you weren't able to even probably process that in the moment, it has stuck with you to this day. So those are the conversations, and those are the things that push you through, which is just So powerful. What, I know you have, you mentioned that you had joined some support groups, which I know grief support groups are going to be different than suicide grief support groups. Have you found groups that have been helpful for you? And how would one go about finding a place like that or a group like that local to them? Because I would imagine that that would be comforting in some way to know that that you aren't alone. And now, you know, you offer this too as a, you know, as private kind of coaching, or do you do group coaching as well for people going through this type thing?
Yeah. So kind of both, and I'll get into that. I do recommend, if someone has lost a loved one specifically to suicide, I do recommend finding a suicide specific support group because of what you're mentioning, that it is different. I have been around people. I actually was offered a couple times to join a death grieving support group. And I said no, because I wasn't in a place to be able to hear other people's stories that were more different than mine. I mean, every story I've heard in regards to someone losing a loved one by suicide is different than my own, but there's this level of community that just exists where I don't have to explain myself. I don't have to explain the circumstances. I can, and people are willing to hear, but there's just an understanding, just like any other grief groups that you could attend or go to. So that, I do recommend that. In my particular situation, my sister found it online. And one of the things I am trying to build are more resources like that per state to be able, so that people could go to my website. It's not up and running yet, but it is kind of a plan so that people could go in and find resources per state. Some will be offered virtually, which can be helpful. I mean, that's how I started, was virtual, because it was during the pandemic. And then now we do more of a hybrid model. For me, I do more of the one-on-one coaching, really just to help people take the first step to identify what core limiting beliefs they may have that are impacting their adulthood. My grief process ended up hitting a block because I was still engaging in some of the loops I had from childhood. So being a people pleaser, a perfectionist, wanting to control outcomes. And these particular themes for me were inhibiting my grief process because I was still buying into messages and projections that I picked up as a kid. So I had to go back and heal those. And that gave me access to really grieve. It's kind of a remarkable journey that I've experienced through it. And so part of the coaching is to help people start to really unravel some of those core limiting beliefs so that they can actually access their grief in a healthy way. The other thing I'll say, though, is that, as I mentioned, that we have grief that's more than just a loss of a person, is I started and had to stop for a little bit, and I'm trying to revamp a grief and movement group. I'm a big believer in kind of the somatic therapy, looking at what's going on in our bodies, where do we hold our grief and our emotions in our bodies, but also being able to tap into the grief about those other areas, our loss of ourselves, what our life was going to be, what it is now, what it's going to be in the future, and allow people to kind of walk through that emotional process with matching that process to certain movement and activities, whether it's climbing or doing a rage room or yoga. So it encompasses all of that. And I'm trying to do that here locally in Colorado, and then see if there will be a way in the future to actually branch out to make that a bigger resource for people. But I'm find the tools. It's important to find the tools. The tools are going to change on a daily basis. Sometimes I meditate, sometimes I journal, sometimes I'm exercising. It just changes per day, but I do encourage people to figure out what tools they can access. And the other piece of this, I feel, is to find something to anchor to, so that when you are having a bad day, that whatever you're anchored to is going to help you get to the next day to keep moving forward.
Right. One question I have for you, and this isn't necessarily pertaining to just suicide. But one thing I've often heard is it's similar to, you know, suicide being an uncomfortable topic to talk about. When someone passes, let's just say, you know, your husband, do you find comfort when people talk about him? Like actually using his name and talking about him, you know, to you about, you know, his life and what he, how he lived and what he left here on this earth. Because so often I feel like after someone passes, regardless of the circumstances, sometimes we just dance around the topic. But at the same time, how do we keep that person's memory alive? So especially with your son, I mean, I know he was young, or and still is young when it happened, but how do you prefer, you know, do you like to keep his memory alive and his name alive in conversations, or is that triggering to you?
Oh, not at all. I love it. I try and encourage. I am around people who feel uncomfortable talking about him, but I love it because, again, when you can detach a little bit from the pain of the death and still right. recognize who the person was, then it's not so triggering. I have my moments. I recently was watching a movie and they were doing a military funeral and doing the whole thing. And I went, "Ooh, I didn't realize that was coming up." And okay, that's a little triggering for me and I need a moment. But my son is a mini of his dad and I love it. I like anybody from Sean's family that sees my son goes, "Oh man, he's got Sean's eyes. That's crazy." I mean, he does. He has his mind and I love it because it's a great reminder of a beautiful soul who just left us too early. And I get how that could be painful, but I, for whatever reason, I love it. We talk about him. My son gets kisses from his dad every night. Anytime he does something that, anytime he does something, I'd be like, "Oh, your dad would find that funny," or "Your dad did stuff like that." Mm-hmm. And we have pictures up, which took a while. Yeah. I know people where they couldn't, I couldn't initially for a while, and then was able to work toward being able to look at pictures. So I think it's a great way. I for my particular situation, I feel that if I didn't talk about him, then it would almost potentially shut down my son's comfort with asking questions. Because right. if I said, "We're not going to talk about your dad," then I want him to be able to ask me questions and I want to find age appropriate language to tell him what happened and to navigate that as we go. But I'm a big proponent of talking to that person, talking about them. My mom years ago made a little Christmas stocking for Sean. So that still comes up and out. And there are all different ways. I've known people who still set the table for their loved one, or you can write letters. I will say I sometimes will go take a camping chair to the cemetery with a cup of coffee and just sit and have a little chat. So I think there are still ways to maintain that connection. And I will also say that's still something to this day that I'm trying to learn is how do I balance or bridge that I get to still have a relationship with Sean where he is now. And also I have this day-to-day stuff that I have to do as well, but I'm all for talking about, because one of the things I'll say too is that one of the most powerful things you can do, especially when it comes to death by suicide, is to say my person, name your person, like my husband Sean died by suicide in August of 2020. So many people have difficulty with being able to actually say that because of our own shame and guilt and perception of that. But there's so much power in being able to say and to release that energy around it. And then to remember them for the, I mean, Sean loved his, I mean, I talk about it in the book, but he loved his Christmas light jammies.
Yeah.
He was a jokester and he was very musically inclined. And so it's like, remember, and not not to the point, because I think this can also happen, is after someone passes, it's almost like they could have no negative traits and we only remember them as the most positive person possible. And I don't go that way either. Like, there are definite things that you can say about someone. You're not dishonoring or being negative if you can admit, like, oh, and also some days this happened or some days that happened and that was really hard. But it doesn't take away from how good a person is, because we all have those positive and negative things going on.
Yeah. I have tears in my eyes just listening to how you have memorialized him and really honored him. And I think it's so powerful and such an example. And one thing that you said in the book that really touched me, and I think it's because I struggle with depression so much, something to the effect of you coming to peace with it, because if him, Sean, staying on this planet with you and your son, if that meant that he also had to live in the agony of his mind every single day, that he made, I'm saying right in quotes, right decision, not condoning it, as you said in your book, but I thought, gosh, that is the most selfless and most purest form of healing, I feel like, that someone could have, to be able to say that and to think that and to look at all of this, the tragedy, and to come out with that perspective is, I mean, it's unreal. And so I know that your book is so needed. And I have a few people in my life that I know have dealt with family members they've lost through suicide. And one of them I already shared your book with, and she said, oh, I've already gotten it. But I think that this book is going to be something that's forever in my toolkit for anyone that ever deals with suicide, that, to have this kind of manual guide is incredible. So I can't even wrap my brain around the full circle moment and growth that must bring in you to be able to write a book like this. And I am sure, we're not going to get into it, but I am sure that some people probably in your life that know, that knew him, that knows your husband, I imagine that some people can't even bring themselves to read the book yet, or that it probably was really hard for you to write it, for, thinking of how is this going to be perceived. But I'm sure you just had to press on with your own mission of what you wanted to do by writing this book.
Yeah. I teared up a little bit there too. So thank you. It's been a journey, and though you and I can have a conversation and I'm going to sound a certain way, please know for the listeners that I still have days where I break down and cry. I still have days where I need to scream, and that's part of the process. And I can speak about it more fluently now because more time has gone by and I still do the work. So I encourage people to do that. But thank you for recognizing that, because it's It's not easy, but again, if I can be an example to another person to bring hope that they can also get through it, then to me, it's worth it. When it comes to this book, I don't have any expectation of anyone to read it. I know that sounds weird. I, of course, want everyone to read it, but for those who are close to me, and who knew Sean, you are absolutely right. For some people, they cannot bring themselves to do it. I think also the anticipation can bring on some anxiety over what is going to be in there. And I don't think it's, I don't want to say as bad, but I think you can understand. I don't think it's as hard for some people as they think it will be, if that right. makes sense. But I tell people, go the pace that you can, because I'm also a big believer. I've started books before and then stopped them, and then the right time comes around and I finish them and go, oh, that's the lesson I was supposed to learn. Right. So I truly believe that people will pick this book up when it's the right time for them to get the right information that they need in that moment. And right. so it's definitely been a journey. I absolutely thought of pulling the plug on this project several times. Sure. In fact, sure. Our mutual friend Allison Cullen said, if you ever did, I would fly up there and tell yeah. you to get your stuff together and finish this. Because there's a lot of imposter syndrome and comparison and what am I doing? And is this going to have any impact? And then again, you know, getting caught up in the outcome of it versus saying if there's one person who finds, and there have been more that, let me say that, like I've had quite a few people reach out and say, you know, this has been really helpful. So thank you for doing this. And that makes it all worth it.
Yeah. How can anyone listening, obviously they can go deeper with you, obviously by purchasing your book, and I'll put that in the show notes. You have a website as well, and I know you have an Instagram presence, mm-hmm. right? What is the best way for someone to contact you if they wish?
Sure. So I do have a website. It's Forward to Joy, all spelled out, forwardtojoy.com. That's the same handle for Instagram at Forward to Joy. And then my email is alexandra@forwardtojoy.com. So I can be reached by either of those. And yes, the book's on Amazon. It's on barnesandnoble.com. I actually just recently saw, if you even just Google the name of the book, a bunch of different options pop up for how to access it. So yeah, I just thank you for being willing to chat about this and be able to hopefully direct people to, again, it's meant to be another tool in your toolbox to access and be yeah. helpful.
Yeah. Well, I will certainly put all of that information in the show notes for anyone listening. And I cannot thank you enough for this conversation.
Oh, I'm so grateful we got to chat today. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Flip the Script, a mental health podcast. I'm your host, Jana Cohn. If you'd like to talk with me one-on-one, I have private sessions available now to book in the show notes. And please, if this episode spoke to you in any way and you want to join me in flipping the script on mental health issues, the best thing you can do is leave a review on whatever platform you're listening from. Or take a screenshot of this episode, tag me, and share to your social media. I'd also love to connect with you in the DMs on Instagram at jana.cohn. In the show notes, you can subscribe to my email list and never miss an episode. I'll see you here next time on Flip the Script.